From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been a fiery week all round. Inferno in California, hot talk on Iran, Democrats burning anger about President Bush's request for more war funds. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger surveyed his state's destruction yesterday.
These fires are among the worst disasters in California history, and the president and I just had a heartbreaking tour of the disaster and some of the devastation.
Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson said more economic sanctions against Iran and its Republican Guard are essential.
In dealing with Iran, it is nearly impossible to know one's customer and be assured that one is not unwittingly facilitating the regime's reckless behavior and conduct.
And Virginia Democrat Congressman Jim Moran voiced outrage at the cost of an unending war.
Every dime of this war in Iraq has been borrowed from our children and from our grandchildren.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. Joining us today from Philadelphia is Trudy Rubin, foreign affairs columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. She's been all over the Iran story and more. Trudy, great to have you back.
Nice to be here, Tom.
With us for the first time today from San Diego, California, fire country, is Ruben Navarreta, a nationally syndicated columnist for the San Diego Union-Tribune. His column appears in almost 200 papers across the country. It's been a devastating work in his world. Ruben Navarreta, thank you very much for joining us.
Tom, hello. Thanks for having me.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Jack, great to have you.
Hello, Tom, Ruben, and Trudy.
Ruben, first to you. You're in fire country. Is it over?
Well, it's over in one regard, in the sense that most of the fires have been contained. There was at one point, it's almost hard to imagine, but 18 different fires raging throughout Southern California within about 750, 800 square miles. And so, you know, things are better now. People are starting to move back to some of the impacted areas. And now you sort of begin the next phase of digging through the rubble, finding out what's left of so many homes. Over 1,000 homes have been destroyed. And then starting the long process of rebuilding. So, you know, it's sort of in that flux period. There's some folks who are moving back who are being warned not to drink the water in, you know, impacted areas like the town of Ramona because the water's contaminated. So for those people, this won't be over in that sense for a long time.
Well, some week, a visual for the country and a tragedy for many right there. Let's hear a little bit of sound out of California first. Here are reporters. Well, reporters had asked Arnold Schwarzenegger about criticism that there were not enough resources early in the crisis, specifically that there were not enough planes, those big, tanker planes, and whether they could have limited the fire spread. He responded here.
Anyone that is complaining about the planes just wants to complain because there's a bunch of nonsense. The fact is that we have all the planes in the world here. We have 90 aircrafts here, and they can't fly because of the wind situation.
90 aircrafts, too much wind. Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff said this week that the government, federal government, had learned from Katrina and had planned better for the crisis in California.
Well, of course, a lot of what we've done over the last 2.5 years is build on lessons we learned from what happened in New Orleans in 2005. And that begins with preparation and planning well in advance of events. We've done a lot of work over the last couple of years with California officials in terms of different kinds of disasters and what we might do. So we were poised to move into action very quickly.
Ruben Navarreta in San Diego, lessons learned. And first, just those, emergency preparedness. How do you rate it?
You know, it's hard to say. I think local officials, I think, performed very, very well. They learned from the Cedar Fire here in San Diego 4 years ago, and a massive fire as well. I think locally they did a very good job. I think Arnold Schwarzenegger did a very good job as well. This was a shining moment for him in terms of his leadership, for sure. On the other hand, though, I think the federal response was perhaps better than it was at Katrina because lessons were learned. But at the same time, there's some very disturbing parallels. I spoke to Michael Chertoff just yesterday, and I have to say as a caveat here, after Katrina, I wrote a column saying that given all the evidence, Michael Chertoff should be fired. And he didn't resign, he should be fired. Because I think that was really the low moment of his tenure as Homeland Security Chief. So given that, our conversation may have been a little tense, you see. But the conversation then became about sort of what else was to blame. Back in Katrina, he was blaming the local officials who picked the wrong evacuation site in the Superdome, yada, yada. Here, he was blaming the wind. And it's just sort of the same songbook for Chertoff. You know, I wonder if, in fact, he's going to be the national point person for natural disasters, no matter where that happens in the country. Exactly. Why are we paying his salary if it's never his fault? It's always somebody else's fault. In this case, it's the fault of the wind.
Blame the wind. Because it's in your backyard, Ruben, I got to stick with you here. What about the big lesson from this? Is it get out of town time or, you know, no more developments? Is that un-American, un-Californian? How's California? We talked about this some this week, but still the question lingers. What does California do with this threat going forward? Bigger fires, more people.
Right, and more drought. I mean, you can't control, for instance, how much rain you get in a given time period. In those parts of the country that are rather lush, where you have, you know, greener fields, and you don't have to worry about what happens when power lines might cross or a fire may get started, and then all of a sudden the winds pick up. The combination of the winds and all that dry material from the drought and all those years was deadly in this case. So there's some things that we can't prepare for in the overall. I think our response has to be, you know, first rate. I think it was in this case. But a lot of people are wondering, you know, why is it that people insist on going back and rebuilding their homes in the same path of the fire? But our perspective on the West Coast, we look to New York and we say, well, why in the world did all those folks move back to New York and Manhattan after 9/11? People are a stubborn breed. You know, they refuse to be pushed around. Americans, one and all, no matter what part of the country we live in, we do things sometimes that our fellow Americans consider irrational, but we do them nonetheless.
Trudy Rubin, I don't know, guys with box cutters, maybe stoppable. Santa Ana winds and Mother Nature, I'm not so sure.
Well, I'm glad I live on the East Coast.
This week?
Yes, this week. Well, Philadelphia, so far we've been lucky.
Lucky Philadelphia.
It does look strange to people on this side of the country. But what looks even stranger and more disturbing is that they're saying that several of these fires might have been started by arson.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, to many Americans, it's just hard to believe that people could get enjoyment out of watching such horror.
I even heard that they have arsonists who go out when the winds are high and deliberately set fires then.
Jeez. Yeah, It's a level of destructiveness that's hard to understand unless you're a psychiatrist.
Speaking of destructiveness and cost, we've got a war going on, the price tag coming around again this week. We can talk as much about the fires as we like, but I want to come to this Iraq and Afghanistan war spending. On Monday, President Bush, aware of his detractors on this in Congress, presented the new budget request of $196 billion as an all-or-nothing proposition for the wars.
I often hear that war critics oppose my decisions, but still support the troops. Well, I'll take them at their word. And this is a chance for them to show it.
A chance for them to show it. The Senate's number two Democrat, Dick Durbin, says the cost of the war is what President Bush and others who call themselves fiscal conservatives should really be dealing with.
He's asking for almost $200 billion for this war in Iraq and quibbling and fighting with us over $22 billion so that we can deal with some of the issues we face at home. We want to make that difference between the president and the Congress very clear.
$22 billion, $200 billion, all peanuts maybe. In front of the House Budget Committee on Wednesday, Congressional Budget Office Director Peter Orszag said total war spending is likely to run into the trillions.
To the extent the spending is not offset by higher taxes or reduced spending elsewhere in the budget, and therefore simply adds to the deficit, the total budgetary impact of the war, including spending to date, possible future spending, and higher interest costs would amount to between $1.7 trillion and $2.4 trillion through 2017.
Now we're talking real money by anyone's measure, Jack. The country is in a war. Wars are expensive, but my, how that ticker goes.
Yes, and that ticker includes $700 billion in interest charges on this war because, of course, we're funding it on the credit card. And this week, Dave Obie, the Democratic congressman, chairman of the Appropriations Committee, came out strongly for a war tax that would basically everybody in the country would have to pay it. And it seems to me that anyone who's a patriot should be behind that. Of course, he won't get anywhere with it. You know, this $2 trillion, we're going to look upon this as the America that could have been, the opportunity costs that involved in this $2 trillion or whatever it will be. Think what that might have done, people will say in the future, and what difference it could have made in every area of our American life if it had been spent here, even if it had been given back to people in tax cuts. Instead, of course, this is going to be $8,000 in tax increases for every man, woman, and child in the country.
Ruben Navarrete, we haven't met. I don't know your politics. Let's hear. How do you hear that kind of trade-off here? Do you see it? We've got a war. There's the spending. We've got a lot of needs at home. How do you look at it?
Wars are expensive, as you said. I mean, here's a bit of my politics. I don't think either Democrats or Republicans have performed very well when it comes to Iraq, and I think the Democrats have a convenient foil in the fact that the president and his administration have made so many incredible mistakes with regard to the war. But that's just really a way of Democrats sort of skirting the real issue, which is, okay, Democrats, how do you propose that we get the troops out of Iraq and still maintain the peace so that the entire region doesn't descend into chaos? And the big question out here in San Diego and elsewhere, because it's home to places like Camp Pendleton, which sends so many Marines to Iraq, we want to know, we want it written down someplace that if the Democrats have their way, we're not going to be sending boys back there, boys and girls back there in 5 years or 10 years or even sooner. So, you know, it's convenient for Durbin and the others to have a president and administration that keeps tripping over its own feet because it keeps people from asking Democrats the real question, which is, how would you do better? What's your plan B? They don't have one.
Okay, what about a war tax then, Reuben? You know, let's pay for it now, David Obey says. Not on the credit card. What do you say?
I say that makes a lot of sense, not on the credit card, because as a 40-year-old, frankly, I get an idea who's paying the credit card. It's going to be me and my kids, you know, as younger people pay the credit card.
Trudy,
and we're not paying for Social Security for baby boomers. We're going to be paying for this.
Trudy, I have a feeling if it was pay-as-you-go, it might well be ended quickly, come what may, 5 years down the road.
Well, I think you put your finger on something a bit ago when you said this is not a war where everybody is sacrificing. And I think that's one of the things that has been the most disturbing about this war. There's no draft, so you have the professional military, and yes, they do sign up, but also the National Guard, which never expected these kinds of deployments, doing all the sacrifice. And I'm on a lot of military blogs, and you can see that people are getting increasingly angry. And I think giving tax cuts at a time when you have expenditures like this is equally irresponsible.
We're looking at a week in the news, wildfire ratcheting up on Iran, a $2 trillion plus price tag on the war. Jack Beatty is with us. Reuben Navarrete from San Diego, syndicated columns with the San Diego Union Tribune, part of the Washington Post writers group there. Trudy Reuben from the Philadelphia Inquirer is here. And Trudy, let me get something else on the table because I want to get you on this as well. Here just yesterday at the House committee hearing, Democrats accused Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice of grossly mismanaging efforts in Iraq and concealing information from Congress. Representative Henry Waxman grilled a visibly frustrated Rice over whether Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki had put himself above the law and blocked corruption inquiries.
His country, his government that we're propping up with the lives of our soldiers and the billions of dollars of our taxpayers' money. And this is not a minor accusation. Now, let me ask you about something else.
Mr. Chairman, precisely because it's not a minor allegation, I think it is worth giving the time to it to fully investigate it before discussing it.
Not a black and white situation here, Trudy. No matter where you stand, war, nowhere, war, then you've got the issue of billions spent where, by whom, how, corruption? Are we, you know, who's keeping track here?
You know, this was a war in which cash was doled out in blocks. I was in Iraq at the beginning after the statue fell and periodically since. But the corruption is endemic, and it's on both sides. There's a non-government in Iraq, which really has no control over the purse. Cabinet ministries are doled out by political party, and so the ministries are basically controlled by a political party. And there's really absolutely no system that there was a great story this week about the Iraqi finance ministry where the U.S. spent a couple of $100 million trying to install some computerized oversight system of finances, and it's not even being used. Money down a rat hole, and there's more appropriated to check it. But there's also been terrific corruption on the U.S. side. I think we haven't even put a finger on that, because when you had so much cash floating around without supervision. Now, maybe this happens in any war, but I think it's particularly egregious in this one, because the lack of preparation beforehand for what would come after clearly is reflected in what you see about the missing millions, tens of millions, and hundreds of millions. And many Iraqis are furious because contracts that they are now saddled with were given out for kickbacks by Americans.
Jack, waste happens in war. But again, there are issues of degree. Henry Waxman wading in there now. You know, is it time for much tougher oversight? Will that work politically?
Well, it's late in the day, isn't it? So much has been spent. And, you know, I think that Secretary Rice's insouciance about this is really telling. I mean, her job, of course, is to monitor this and is to keep her the spending that's been going on and, indeed, the Blackwater connection, the State Department's use of private contractors. And, you know, as one looks into this, it's plain that the administration did not even try to put in the field the accountants, the inspectors, people to monitor this money. They seem to have the idea that if you just threw money at Iraq, it would all come out all right. Well, it isn't. And the scandals about there was a building they built, a hospital, where excrement was leaking through the ceiling. The scandals now about the American embassy. Is it being built with somehow labor that's being abused? The cost overruns. It is within the larger disgrace and debacle of Iraq. This is just intensification of that.
Sure, Trudy. Thanks, Jack. Trudy.
If one was there, as I was, at the beginning of this thing, the whole thing is a consequence of lack of foresight. The United States expected Iraqi ministries to snap back to attention, and you could simply funnel money through a working liberal system. This was the original sin, the original total misconception. Once security broke down immediately after the Americans came in and the insurgency started, once all of the ministries were gutted by looting when we didn't stop it, you had no functioning system in Iraq. And then the U.S. had to cope. It was impossible to set up normal accounting systems, but the breakdown was the result of the lack of U.S. planning and the total misconception of what you would face after a war.
Let's hear from our listeners. Sylvia is calling from St. Albans, Vermont. Hi, Sylvia. You're on the air.
Thanks. I was against this war from the beginning, but I still... to use the old cliche, support our troops.
What does that mean to you now, Sylvia?
It means that I support the military that's there, spending, blood and life for, I really don't know why, but I mean, if they have to do it, they have to do it.
So it's a kind of empathetic support. It's empathy with their sacrifice is what you're describing there in a way.
Exactly. I mean, I would prefer they would all be here at home. But what really grates me is how much of our taxes are being spent on the contractors over there. If one contract firm can have a $4 billion bill in 1 year, how much are we spending on contractors compared to what we are spending on and for our troops?
In fairness, I believe that's $4 billion for all the contractors there, but it is an enormous number. Ruben Navarrete, what about it? Our caller Sylvia's observation and Trudy's description of where things went wrong, was this a war of dreamers? She says they just weren't at grips. The foresight wasn't there. Is it a war of dreamers?
Well, it may well be, but it gets back into discussion about whether it was a war of necessity or war of choice. And, I think a caller makes a good point, and it's an honest point. She's speaking from the heart, saying that she doesn't support this mission, and she never supported the mission, but she finds it difficult to not send troops what they need in terms of, equipment.
But that's easy. That's the easy part. But if they're given, leadership without foresight, it looks pretty easy. We've sent hundreds of billions with barely a complaint on that front until it starts to add up like this.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. In Congress, there's a debate over it, so it's not so easy. I think those folks in Congress who are complaining about the economics of it, it's really sort of odd to hear them talk this way, because I don't really think this is about dollars and cents at all. I don't think this is something you can chart out on a ledger. This is not about economics. This is about This is about people who supported the mission to begin with, or who support the mission now, or who never liked the president, who never supported the president. And this thing about hanging your hat on the cost of the war as if somehow the cost wasn't so high, we would be more supportive of the war. That's nonsense.
You think it's all just about attitudes toward George Bush? That sounds way too easy.
There's an issue of accountability.
I think the idea of the cost of the war, that somehow there's this magical threshold at which we say, oh my goodness, I supported up to now, but now it's too expensive. I don't think most people think that way. And I think that a lot of this has to do with how you feel about the war originally. If you thought that going to Afghanistan, for instance, was much more justifiable than going to Iraq, then you were willing to spend whatever it took to go to Afghanistan. This is about how we feel about Iraq.
We're going to get on over the border to Iran in just a second here. I want to get one more caller on Iraq from Ticonderoga, New York. There's a name out of war history. Ken, you're on the air.
Hey.
What do you know, Ken?
Well, what do I know? It's more like what do I suspect. I've got deep suspicions that these guys, and I say these guys, I'm talking about Bush, Cheney, and Republicans at large, on spending on the war, they really don't care. The bottom line is, the more they spend, the further they drive us into a financial hole, the less chance there is going to be straightened out Social Security, et cetera. I mean, Fred Thompson already floated the trial balloon. Let's just cut it 25%.
Right.
What they're going to say is, geez, you know, we just don't have the money.
So maybe this is another way to strangle that baby in the bathtub, the famous thing. Ken, thanks very much for that. I want to get on to Iran, if I may, because we're coming up on the break here, and we barely begin to touch it, and it's huge. Let's hear just a couple bits of tape here. On Sunday, Vice President Cheney made a speech before an audience of Middle East experts. He characterized Iran as the world's most active state sponsor of terrorism.
The Iranian regime needs to know that if it stays on its present course, the international community is prepared to impose serious consequences. The United States joins other nations in sending a clear message. We will not allow Iran to have a nuclear weapon.
Then yesterday, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice branding the Republican Guard a terror-supporting group. She said yesterday the administration is imposing sanctions on Iranian banks and the Revolutionary Guard.
No U.S. citizen or private organization will be allowed to engage in financial transactions with these persons and entities. In addition, any assets that these designees have under U.S. jurisdiction will be immediately frozen.
Trudy Rubin, everybody in the White House, the administration, saying yesterday this is not about going to war, but what is going on here?
I think a couple of things are going on here. There is the same ongoing dispute within the administration that there was over how to deal with many issues, North Korea. And so it's diplomacy versus military. Vice President Cheney, it's an open secret, would like to see a more robust, shall we say, military action against Iranian nuclear sites that are supposedly dedicated to energy, but that many people think ultimately would be a bomb. Condoleezza Rice is trying diplomacy. It isn't working. UN sanctions not moving forward because of Russia or China. So there's an effort to turn the screws. And some people say, oh, it's simply to put more sticks on to try to get diplomacy to work. What's worrying is that both the president and Vice President Cheney are using new language. The president said last week that the Iranians would not be allowed to get the knowledge to build a bomb. This makes us in a shorter time frame. And Vice President Cheney, using much more robust language, will not allow. So it does raise the question of whether, if diplomacy crawls along, there will be pressure before the end of the administration to take military action.
Does more robust military action, your representation of Cheney's desire, does that equal war? Does that mean war? Is there anything, in the middle ground?
I think that this is like the Iraq War, the law of unintended consequences. There has been some speculation that attacks would be simply on military installations or camps of the Al-Quds forces, the ones that control Iranian activity abroad, such as in Iraq. But ask yourself, what does that achieve? You start something and you don't know where it would end. My guess is if there were military action, it would also be much, much broader against nuclear installations, because after all, if you get into it, you know the Iranians are going to retaliate, so what's the good of a pinprick? But then once you're into it, where do you go? How do you stop it?
What about the Iranian side, Trudy? You've been out there. We saw this week the chief Iranian nuclear negotiator stepping down. Is something going on in Iran? Is the pressure maybe working?
No, I mean, it's the other way around. I think what's happening is you have hardliners on both sides gaining strength. You have the Iranians, I think, coming to the point where they believe the United States is so bogged down in Iraq that they don't need to negotiate. Back in 2003, when the Iranians were worried, we'd dumped the Taliban, we'd succeeded in dumping Saddam, they put out feelers, very strong feelers, for negotiations on everything. The United States at that point wasn't interested. We were in the driver's seat. Now Iran thinks it's in the driver's seat and doesn't need to negotiate. They've changed nuclear negotiators. The man who quit, Mr. Larijani, was a hardliner but pragmatist. The new man from the foreign ministry, Saeed Jalili, I've interviewed him. He is Ahmadinejad clone, and he's thinking also a longtime friend. I think the negotiations now will go nowhere because the Iranians think that the Americans can't do anything about it. And, of course, that frustrates the administration, which increases the pressure for military action.
Boy, great. Let's take a call from Montreal, Canada. Ahmed, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. I just want to mention that under the non-proliferation agreement, Iran is not breaking any laws. They have the inspections. They're following everything. On the other side, we have Israel, which has nuclear bombs, and nobody's saying anything. But concerning Iran, everybody's real hard about them. Stop doing this. We're going to invade, all that. So I just want to mention that hypocrisy. What about it?
I can. Trudy?
Sure. I mean, the point is that Iran is a party to the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. They're supposed to do certain things. They hid a nuclear program for many years, and it is the fact that they hid the program that has caused the IAEA to suspect that they actually are designing a military program.
Israel's been open about its program?
No, Iran, Israel is not a signatory, which is one of the bizarre things about this. Israel denies, although it's an open secret. But, I mean, the point is that because Iran is a signatory, it has obligations. It didn't meet them. And that's why the IAEA is demanding answers.
Bomb's a bomb, with or without the piece of paper, I guess. Ruben, where do you stand here? We have to be ready to go, to roll on, Iran?
I think I'd like to stand with Israel, given the choice, and also with various members of the American Jewish community that are saying, whoa, wait a minute, this does not look good. It has less to do with who signed what treaty and more to do. And I don't dismiss that. I think that's important. But it has more to do with sort of what would Iran see if they could redesign the globe, and would there be a spot for the United States on the globe, and would there would be a spot for Israel on the globe? It would be if somebody could assure me that if Iran had nuclear weapons, we wouldn't have to worry about our safety. Israel wouldn't have to worry about their safety. I'd feel better about that. So, you know, I like beating up on Dick Cheney as much as the next person, and I don't mind criticizing his robust language, but I don't think this is a manufactured crisis. I think this has a lot to do with what's happening on the ground in Iran and what Iran's designs are for Israel and for us.
Jack Biddy, let me come to you. How do you read the tea leaves here, Jack, or the war drums, or call it what you will?
Well, you know, in Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper yesterday, Foreign Minister Lizni was quoted as saying, I think at a cabinet meeting, that that Iran does not pose an existential threat to Israel, and that Prime Minister Olmert should climb down from some of his language about that. Now, this is at the time, of course, when Iran is bleeding into the presidential campaign. It's clear to me, at least, that Iran, one way or another, will be on the ballot in the 2008 election. Rudy Giuliani, surrounded by Norman bombs away Podhoretz, clearly will go as far as he can to take the country to war with Iran. Now we have Admiral Mitt Romney talking about bombarding Iran if they go forward. Meanwhile, on the Democratic side, what do you have? Well, Hillary and Obama are exchanging memos about you know, her support of the Iran resolution in the Senate. But the main thing is, are they going to step up and say, look, the military says there's no way to do this. This would be suicide. We either have to deal with these people or deter them in some other way.
We're looking at a week in the news. Baseball's in flight this week, and candidates and moon probes. GOP contender and former mayor of a certain large city, Rudy Giuliani, shocked New Yorkers this week with this flip-flop.
I got to tell you, I'm rooting for the Red Sox in the World Series.
Ho, those Red Sox are up 2-0 in the series as the Colorado Rockies look to make a comeback. Rockies manager Clint Hurdle.
We haven't helped ourselves when we've been able to. We've made enough mistakes that have cost us a little bit and put ourselves in a hole here.
And China launched its first satellite outside of Earth orbit on Wednesday, a 2-ton lunar probe that will orbit the moon for a year. Get used to it, the sound of a Chinese blast off there. Ruben Navarrete joins us from San Diego. He's been right in the thick of the firestorm, the fire this week. He's a syndicated columnist with the San Diego Union-Tribune, part of the Washington Post Writers Group. Trudy Ruben is with us from the Philadelphia Inquirer, author of Willful Blindness. Jack Beatty's here. Steve's calling from Fort Erie, Canada. Steve, you're on the air.
Yeah, well, first of all, I'd like to say that incompetence is not a political sin. And I think a lot of what happens is disguised through incompetence.
Why is incompetence not a political sin? It looked costly in the Katrina case.
And who keeps winning? Who won the...
The fall elections, the 06, the Democrats won.
And what happened? Anyway, that's not my point.
Yeah.
My point is about the war with Iraq and Iran.
Mm.
They want to drive up the price of oil. It's a Naomi Klein disaster capitalism textbook case. Destroy the American economy, and those guys at the top, the hedge fund guys, will make it like bandits, and they can reorganize America into a nice little Robert Heinlein type society.
Oh boy, we got doomsday here. But oil is back 90, and maybe even over 90. I mean, Ruben, you know, all of this is really pushing oil prices around. It does make you wonder, about the knock on effect of these conflicts.
Right, exactly. I mean, some naive Americans would have believed that if you were going to war, if you believe that the war is about oil, then shouldn't the prices of oil be going down? Who's exactly benefiting from this? And I think the syndicate in me takes a look at
Exxon's not doing too badly. Record prices.
Exactly.
Halliburton's not doing too badly.
Halliburton. An earlier caller talked about the amount of money that goes to contractors, and we certainly haven't thought enough about that, I think, in this country. But, I think most Americans would feel much better if all of this money were going to troops and not to contractors. So I think there's a little bit of counterintuitive there. If you're in the middle here, you're an American, and you see your gas prices go up, and at the same time you're at war in Iraq for a war that people say was about oil, it's all very confusing, isn't it?
Steve talks about political sins. I don't know if that's going to be on the fiscal front, on the tax front, the war front, or maybe the cultural front. At Sunday's Republican debate, the candidates took aim at each other, and again, Hillary Clinton. Here's Senator John McCain's attack.
In case you missed it, a few days ago, Senator Clinton tried to spend $1 million on the Woodstock Concert Museum. Now, my friends, I wasn't there. I'm sure it was a cultural and pharmaceutical event. I was tied up at the time, but the fact is...
There it is. John McCain, Vietnam vet, POW, takes aim at Woodstock vet, generation Hillary Clinton. Jack, what do you make of the politics here? Is McCain hitting on something that still works? Are we fighting the 60s again in 07, 08?
Well, I think we will be. That, I thought, was a very effective in the whole campaign. That's the best soundbite. McCain is now using it in an ad. And it may well help McCain. It will remind voters, Republican voters, what they like about him. That is, he's an American hero, and then he can say things like that. But I do think behind everything, the 60s stuff will resonate. However, if Rudolph Giuliani is the Republican candidate, as seems at least possible now, if not likely, it's going to be very hard to raise these moral issues given his personal life.
Trudy, what about it? Back to Woodstock and Vietnam. Are we really going to fight those wars in addition to Iran and, Iraq
no,
and
no,
who
no.
knows?
I think this election, Iraq is going to be front and center. However much things may have improved on the ground in certain places, it's still going to be a mess. Iran is going to be a big issue. Rudy Giuliani has an advisor, was mentioned, Norman Podoretz, who recently met with the president in the White House, who is famous for his essay, Why We Must Bomb Iran. And if you think oil prices are an issue now, if we got into an air war with Iran, there's no prediction about how high they would go. And just to make a point about that, there's also no prediction about whether we could stop their weapons program, and we would be strengthening hardliners, and we would be dooming ourselves in Iraq. And this is why the whole military top brass is steadfastly against bombing Iran. So I think these issues are going to be front and center, and also responsibility for the mistakes of the war. There has to be responsibility.
President Bush, you know, made the equation Iranian bomb equals World War III last week. But is there room for some kind of, you know, negotiated exit from this standoff treaty? Or does the U.S. have a starker choice of Iranian bomb or war?
I think there is room, but it will be very difficult. As I said, I think it was very possible back in 2003 when we were stronger. I think it will have to wait for the next president. I think that the Iranian top powers, the supreme leader, the cleric Ali Khamenei, has ruled out negotiations with George Bush. I think the Bush administration has a problem. They can't decide whether their policy is change of behavior by Iran or regime change. So even if the Iranian regime was more willing, you have a situation where both Bush and Cheney are making very unveiled hints at wanting regime change in their speeches last weekend and last week, and where we are helping ethnic groups, non-Persian inside Iran, fomenting unrest, including, it appears, there are stories to that effect, helping to stir up Kurds inside Iran. So this administration can't decide. The next one, if it wants talks, will have to talk on a much broader framework on all the issues in the Middle East that concern us with Iran.
So trying to stir up maybe Kurds in Iran, trying to tamp down Kurds, the PKK in Turkey next door. This is very complicated business. I want to look at politics and policy on a different front. Reuben, Jack, at home, Charlie Rangel is talking, Democrat, is talking about big tax proposals in Congress maybe next year. Jack, what's he proposing, and what are the political ramifications of Democrats raising big tax changes in a presidential campaign year?
Well, basically what he's proposing is a tax cut for about 90% of 90 million Americans, and a tax increase on 2 million. The 2 million have the money. He wants to get rid of the alternative minimum tax and to deal with the shortfall, about nearly $1 trillion, by increasing taxes on the very wealthy, including the hedge fund managers.
What does very wealthy mean there, Jack? Do you know? Do you have
It seems to be above $500,000.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the hedge fund managers would be first in line. It came out recently that taxing just 25 of these people at the normal rate for income would yield $2 billion a year. Meanwhile, Harry Reid, 2 weeks ago, the Senate Majority Leader, reassured the hedge funders, don't worry, we're not going to bring up taxing you this year, and it'll probably won't happen next year because it'll be an election year. Now, of course, the hedge funders are all with the Democrats. They're spending lots of money on them. They're they're giving it to their campaigns. And so we'll have to see whether this party of the people will be able to hold out for the 25 people who could contribute $2 billion if they just pay taxes at the normal rate to our budget.
Reuben, how do you see taxes in the presidential campaign? Republicans picking up on Charlie Rangel, already talking about the mother of all tax hikes here. Has the ground shifted? Can Charlie Rangel turn this around and change it into an equity issue or Democrats? Or is it, you know, will it always be portrayed as here come the Democrats, they want to tax you, and the Republicans happy to talk about that all night and all day on the stump?
Right. They want to soak the rich, I think. And I think I don't think Rangel himself can turn this around and get away from that. But I also don't think that Republicans have a prayer of being able to turn this to their advantage. Republicans, I think, are, and we all know this, in very deep trouble when it comes to the possibility of facing someone like Hillary Clinton in the fall of next year. So
they sound like they want it. They're all slathering.
Yeah,
you know, the
right.
Hillary name is out there every other second in the debate.
Yep.
You don't think
be
so?
Careful. Yeah, be careful what you wish for, guys, because she's a lot more formidable than they think. And I think that they don't have a prayer of being able to take the mantra of, hey, they just want, you know, class envy, tax the rich, and turn it into political victory. Having said that, though, it's kind of bold of Democrats to even be having this conversation. It must be a sense that they are much confident. They are very confident in the hand they're holding. And they also, frankly, need money. I mean, they need money because if they see the White House in the offing and they think they're going to get to a point where they control the White House and both houses of Congress, they've got big plans. They need lots of money. They know the bill in Iraq is depleting resources. And so they need to find a new reservoir, and that's going to be taxes.
Trudy?
I should point out, John, this is not a tax increase. This is revenue neutral. This is a tax shift. Mm-hmm. It's 90 million Americans will get a tax cut. So this is not a tax increase. It's a tax shift from the middle class and the upper middle class to the very wealthy.
Well, we know how that works in politics. It can be described many, many, many different ways. Let's think for a second about the Republican phalanx of contenders here and the sort of arm wrestling over who's the conservative. On Sunday night, again, in the debate, Fred Thompson and Rudy Giuliani disagreed over Chris Wallace's question, who's the real conservative in the race?
Mayor Giuliani believes in federal funding for abortion. He believes in sanctuary cities. He's for gun control. He supported Mario Cuomo, a liberal Democrat, against a Republican who's running for governor, then opposed the governor's tax cuts when he was there. So I simply disagree with him on those issues, and he sides with Hillary Clinton on each of those issues I just mentioned.
Mayor Giuliani, well, look, why don't you respond to Senator Thompson?
You know, Fred has his problems, too. I mean, Fred was the single biggest obstacle to tort reform in the United States Senate. He stood with Democrats over and over again. The senator has never had executive responsibility. He's never had the weight of people's safety and security on his shoulders. I have.
Fred has his problems, too. And the New York mayor speaks right there. Trudy, what do you make of it? The wrestle over who's the real conservative here?
I just think it's all extremely humorous. Every time I see Fred Thompson standing next to his trophy wife, everybody except Mitt Romney, or many of the candidates except Mitt Romney, have trophy wife problems with conservative perceptions. I mean, maybe not with the rest of the world. And then Mitt Romney, as anyone from Massachusetts, which I am, knows, he's changed all his positions. His health plan was similar to Hillary's. Now he's against it. So what's a pro-conservative to do, I ask?
Ruben, where do you see this going? It hasn't gone away yet. Republicans just like a rock in their shoe about the, right. You know, where's the conservative savior in this lineup?
Yeah, you know, it's really a misplaced discussion to have because it centers around one word often, and Thompson mentioned it. It's abortion. This becomes about the abortion debate, and it becomes about the possibility that Republicans will go with their front runner, who is Rudy Giuliani, who has a moderate, to my mind, a correct and sensible position on abortion. And, you know, just because I agree with his position, I think that there are a lot of Americans out there in the middle who do agree with his position. A lot of Republican primary voters feel differently. This all comes down to abortion. If I never hear that word again in the context of a presidential campaign, it'll be too soon. And what I find interesting is really, very quickly, in the recent debate, it seemed that the real dividing line wasn't about abortion at all, but rather about trade, because you have all these Republicans out there, Duncan Hunter, Ron Paul, and Mike Huckabee, sounding like populist Democrats. So if you want to have a conversation about who's a real conservative, let's have that conversation about trade, but not about abortion.
Between those two, those are both pretty big, though. Neither likely to go away. Does it mean that the GOP, you know, kind of limps toward November 08 with that rock and unresolved? Or do you see a resolution out there somewhere, Ruben?
Over the issue of who's a real conservative?
Yeah.
You know, I don't see a resolution at all. I think you end up with Rudy Giuliani and getting a lot of positive feeling from folks. People like his executive experience. They trust him. There's a reason he's a front runner. And I think a lot of religious conservatives and social conservatives feel uncomfortable with Giuliani. They're not going to just miraculously become more conservative with him or comfortable with him and think him more of a conservative. Mm-hmm. They're obviously looking for a candidate even as we speak. So this will not be resolved. I think that they will very much go into the election, if not limping, at least divided.
Tim's calling from Aiken, South Carolina. Tim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
All the money that's being spent, or a good portion of the money being spent to fund the war, is being borrowed. And I'm wondering what your panel thinks concerning how does that factor into the tax situation and the potential for Democrats raising taxes. I'll take my answer off the air.
The credit card war, Jack, I mean, that total does mount. The Republican view has been kind of, we'll go for growth and we'll go for victory and it will all work out. Do the Democrats have a different formulation for looking at that? If they, let's say, they come into power with the Congress, both houses, and the White House in 2008?
In a word, no. David Obey's proposal for a war tax, Nancy Pelosi says, no, we're not going to go ahead with that. So their position, it seems to me, on financing the war is indistinguishable from the Republicans. You know, to get back to this issue of the true conservative, I think Giuliani helped himself last weekend at the Values Voters Convention. He gave a very strong presentation where he basically said, as he's been saying to other audiences, look, you may not agree with me on some things, but look at the things you agree with me on. And he was also making the point, without really hitting it too strongly, I'm the one that can beat, guess who? Hillary Clinton. You don't want her for president, go for me. And people were coming out saying, well, you know, that didn't seem so bad. We're rethinking this idea of perhaps a third-party challenge. And meanwhile, they were coming out shaking their heads about Fred Thompson, whose bald pate they could observe throughout the speech because he's giving a speech because he was bent over.
You beating up on bald guys? Who cares? Oh, the cue card problem.
And Thompson this week has been quoted as saying one day, this is about somebody, some trouble with his delegates. He says, it's hard to figure out, so I don't try. About another matter, someone resigning in New Hampshire says, you know, I can't really address who's doing what or who's doing what at every level of my campaign. Ask the experts about that. That's his own campaign.
Well, a little bit of a Reagan echo there, maybe. Hey, Trudy, we don't get you every week. In a nutshell, Turkey and the Kurds, do they go after them or is this on the shelf for now?
I think there's a chance that they can work it out, but the U.S. has a crucial role to play. We sort of dropped the ball. We had a special rep there, a general. He went home. We didn't replace. Now we're going to have to work really hard at this to calm the Turks down. They have a real grievance.
So an eye on that corner. It's a corner of quite a picture. Trudy Rubin with the Philadelphia Inquirer. Always great to have you. Trudy, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Rubin Navarrete in San Diego. Your part of the world has had a rough week. We hope it gets better next week. Thank you very much for being here, Ruben.
Thank you.
And Jack, great to have you, my friend. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. Oh, people in Dutchess County, Dick Cheney is hunting there this weekend.
Okay.
Be careful.
Heads up, heads down. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.